radio shows here. That would be poo-poo. Remember when we went back to NAFTA, which was run through in the mid-1990s during a lame duck Congress, as a matter of fact, and people were warning that we were turning over large chunks of our sovereignty and control over our economy to a group of unelected, unaccountable individuals. That was hooted down. How do you counter that and try to show this to people?
Well, the way I counter it, and where I think our Achilles heel is in this context, is the vulnerability of our judicial system. And we're seeing that in the confirmation hearings we had of Judge Roberts, and we'll see it again, I think, with Justice Alito. When you have a forum or a set of forums that purport to speak for the world, and that's what these UN global summits purport to do. They don't represent you and me. They represent the activists who have dominated their agenda. But they are recognized and vested with a certain amount of legitimacy, so that when they put out an interpretation or a norm a statement of what human rights in a particular context requires, and that gets picked up by our judges, and that's happening, and that becomes incorporated into our Constitution, and that's happening, that's how we can slowly lose our self-identity as a country under our own Constitution. And that's the story that I try to tell in Global Deception, and I do it through the words of the advocates for this global governance or one world government agenda that the UN has followed. Kofi Annan, as I said, I profile a man named Maurice Strong, who became entangled in the oil for food scandal, but he's been around the UN for 30 years. He was the author of the Kyoto Protocol, and he's come up with something called the Earth Charter, which is a whole other story. That
was a Mikhail Gorbachev co-author as well, too.
That's correct. There's another bizarre example of how far these people go. The Earth Charter was characterized as a set of human values and values of how we are to behave toward the sacred earth and principles of humanity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that both Gorbachev and Maurice Strong, the two original authors of the Earth Charter, compared to the Ten Commandments. And what I find interesting is, and that's their words, they compared it to the Ten Commandments. And what I find interesting is that this Earth Charter is showing up in all of our schools. There's even a children's version of this thing. And it was carried to the United Nations in a procession housed in an ark, believe it or not, in its own ark with unicorn horns in the front to wave off evil. I kid you not. But the irony is that we don't hear a peep from the ACLU about this form of religion being introduced into the public schools and spoon-fed to children. We don't hear a peep from the ACLU when the mayor's conference and individual cities' councils have officially endorsed this new Ten Commandments, the Earth Charter. But that's what we're finding. And again, the UN has been used as an instrument to take money out of our pockets to finance their global rules that spin out of all these forums and summits, and that will control what you and I as Americans take for granted as our way of life.
Well, it would seem like they'd like to control everything we do. If you look at, say, for example, the Codex Alimentarius, which Europe is putting through now, and they're trying very hard to get that implemented here, in other words, in terms of what we can eat and drink. In every facet, there is something in treaties, but these people seem to be, I guess, at best socialist in their orientation, and at worst, almost downright Marxist, to my analysis.
Well, they're all about redistributing income. And Global Deception has a section about a program that's been percolating in the UN for years, several years, and gave rise to yet another summit actually in New York this past September, and that's the Millennium Development Goals. And John Bolton tried to harness this a little bit, ran into quite a bit of resistance. And to make a long story short, what that was all about was, in effect, assessing against the gross national product of every developed country as much as 0.7% of the nation's entire wealth and redistribute to the undeveloped countries, many of which are corrupt, and we would be putting this money into sinkholes. Now, to put that in perspective, if we applied that percentage to the United States total gross national product wealth today, we would have to fork over to this UN program approximately $70 billion a year. And within 10 years, which is when they are looking to have these various Millennium Development Goals achieved, we would be turning over as much as $150 billion just out of our own pockets to an unaccountable UN program. And we look at the Internet again, we started the conversation with. Although I believe, at least for now, we've avoided the worst-case scenario in this summit that's happening this week in Tunisia, and that is that the United States, through the nonprofit organization ICANN, the Internet Corporation for Assignment of Names and Numbers, will continue to manage the Internet day-to-day. That is not going to be taken away, at least in the immediate future. But there will be a Internet Global Governance Forum to discuss policy issues. And I bet you, as we're sitting here, that will be used to press an Internet tax, what they call a bit tax. And the reason I say that, and as Global Deception points out, is that the UN Secretariat has already laid that out in some of its official documents, going back to 1999, when they talked about an Internet bit tax that would have yielded, if it had been enacted, $70 billion a year. So this is what we're up against. And a lot of countries, certainly most of the undeveloped countries that would stand to benefit from it, whether they would use it for their poor or not, probably not, and countries in Europe, particularly France, want to see this happen because it's a way to keep the United States down.
Yeah, but you can see that the political attitudes of, say, even France and those of the U.S. are radically different. The philosophies of what the Internet should and should not be used for, and that's where the collisions begin to happen.
That's right. You mentioned politically correct issues. France doesn't even want to see our movies over there because they think their own cinema industry is threatened and their culture is threatened by what they call the Anglo-Saxon invasion. And so I can just imagine if they participate in the global Internet forum, we're going to start seeing politically correct speech codes, which would be antithetical to our First Amendment. But they can, you know, over time enforce it because the Internet only works if it's all interconnected, and to the extent to which they can use forums to create
views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-24-7234. 845-4237. Or you can go to our online Audience Participation Center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Well, welcome to the second hour of the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. I'm Michael Shaw, and this hour we're going to move from the sustainable developers and their political operatives that worked so hard in the 20th century in America to bring us what is now known as sustainable development. And we're going to drop back even a little further in history and get off the political operatives and talk about the philosophy that is so prominent today, a philosophical notion that just isn't discussed and isn't taught in the schools, but when alerted to it, you'll see its impacts everywhere. Tonight's guest is William Roberts. Shortwave listeners across the country know him as Will from Missouri. Now, you know, as the light began to dawn for me in the late 90s on the notions that something was up in America, I told my brother that there were founding fathers types brewing or rebrewing across this country. Well, Will Roberts is one of them. Welcome, Will.
Good evening, Michael. Thank you for inviting me onto the airwaves with you this evening.
Well, I'm looking forward to this, and this is going to be a little different than I think one could find any radio show in America operating at today, because what we're going to try to do here is have Will explain the depths of some heavy research that you've engaged in and put it in the context which is relevant for people who are trying to understand why it is that there's an unsettling aura in the airs of America today.
That's well put, Michael. And there is an unsettling air. It's almost a cloud that lies out there. But there is an all-out war raging between legal positivism and the natural law. And tonight I hope to be able to provide an inquiry into the origin and the impact of the positivism of Auguste Comte. You might style it the beyond the industrial revolution and the counter-revolution of science. And we need to dive right in, because we've got so much to cover and so little time to do it, that if we don't get the core of his philosophy, we won't be able to understand the legal impacts that are around us today.
Well, let's go.
Okay. Basically, we're looking at a little giant with a very long name. His name is Isidore Auguste Marie Francois Xavier Comte, and that's a mouthful. He was born in 1798 and died in 1857 in his 59th year. So he died a relatively young man, but he has had a tremendous impact. He was a mathematician, a professor, a philosopher, and a savant. A savant is someone that studies wide, reads deep, and writes a lot, and has followers, and all of those apply to Comte. In 1819, Auguste Comte began using the name Auguste. I don't know what he used before then. I've never found a good book that would open up his life, and his writings reveal nothing. Comte took his education at École Polytechnique in Paris. With only written history as our guide, it's nearly impossible to grasp the incredible turmoil that existed in France and Europe in the decades preceding and following Comte's birth. Only a thin line separated the sane from the insane, and who could call whom insane? Mental, spiritual, and political anarchy was the rule of the day. It was everywhere. And the most profound political expression that I've found in the 19th century was that to destroy, you must replace. That ought to give you an idea of what kind of a mindset was going on there. It was absolutely incredible. The blood was everywhere, the guillotine was going, horses in the streets, gas lights, stay up late at night, stay off the streets. It was dreadful. But hidden in plain view, Comte's enormous influence on Asian, English, European, and American thought, his concept of the social physics, which he considered the capstone of the sciences. These are key words. We'll find these all throughout the mystery religions and the masonry and whatnot, but he considered it the capstone of the sciences. As he published it, it was the system of positive philosophy, followed immediately almost by his system of positive politics, and culminating years later in the Catechism of the Positive Religion. So he was really covering the bases. He's known variously, his writings are known variously as Comteism, which most people haven't heard of, humanitarianism, which we've all heard of, or as he coined it, positivism, which very few know about, altruism, which some take on as a lifestyle, but as most say, the social engineers. And Comte's reordering of society along positive principles advocated a new world order, wherein mental, moral, and political anarchy, and this is important, could no longer exist, wherein the humanities and sociology would take their rightful place as the new queen of sciences, trumping philosophy, wherein the Catholico-metaphysical feudalism, that's his term, it defines something, manifested through the conquest and dominion, gives way to a positive polity. A polity is our way of life, a government. And it's the maturity of humanity. And this evening, whenever I say humanity, think of it as a capital H, humanity, with love for principle, order for basis, and progress for end.
Now, let's hold on there for a minute, because a couple of terms that you used, Catholico-feudalism.
Yes.
By that, what do you mean?
Okay, what Comte meant, in the Catholico-metaphysical feudalism, we must remember that at this time, just prior, the Holy Roman Empire had collapsed. And so, it would be easy on the streets of Paris in the early 1800s, after Napoleon I had run his course of bloodshed and destruction around Europe, to consider that Catholicism had been trumped by the secular world and there were going to be a thing of the past. And so his Catholico-metaphysical is important because metaphysics, he viewed Protestantism and all of its sects as the metaphysical side of the theological debate. So we have the Catholico, which ran for 1,500 years, and then we had the Protestant era, which was really feeling its oats and going strong. And the feudalism is the system that was run and set up by the church with the divine right of kings and the infallibility of the Pope and the papacy.
And the social anarchy that you reference, his plan, he claimed, would end social anarchy, so that's a reflection of the French Revolution and the spirit of the times, I presume?
Yes, the whole spirit around the entire area. What Comte did was, he was waging a persistent campaign against Protestant metaphysics, and we'll understand it better. His primary targets were Protestant social and political ideas, individual liberty, freedom of thought, the sovereignty of the people. These, in his judgment, threatened social stability and promoted universal anarchy. Comte's goal was to bring to an end moral and mental anarchy forever. Comte desired to make the world safe for order and lasting stability, ordo ab chaos. Comte advocated the use of all available means towards modifying human behavior and thought. Let's repeat that. I've got to. He advocated the use of all available means towards modifying human behavior and thought.
Well, you know, he's talking about a new world order.
Yes, exactly.
And of course, why we're talking about it is that this isn't the rantings of a man long since dead. This is what we're seeing in America and around the world today.
That's right. There's several people that like to use the phrase coming on us and at us.
That it is. Now, you used another expression as you did that initial analysis: love for principle, order for basis, and progress for end. Now, those all sound like they sound as warm and fuzzy as sustainable development. What did he mean by love for principle, order for basis, and progress for end?
Well, there can be no doubt about the order. If you go back and look, there was a man whose name was Derrière, and he said at the very same time that, gentlemen, your materials are disorder, and with them you must organize order. We're talking about a time of complete upheaval and anarchy. And so when he was looking at order, he was absolutely opposed to revolutionary, anarchical stuff. He didn't like the opponents, so to speak. He was definitely a very conservative person. He strove for stability and order in society. The other two, love for the, what was that? Love for principle. How does that run? Here it is. Love for principle, order for basis, and progress for the end. In the positive world that he visioned, progress was going to be our end goal. It wasn't going to be conquest. It would be material production. And we'll get to that. We'll cover that. I've got it in each of the succeeding stages that he developed. But in order to really get a handle on him and his science, we need to understand the science that it's based on. And what Comte did was he went back through the ages and all of the various sciences, and he examined all of them. He was an encyclopedic mind. He read and he read and he read and he read, and he studied and he studied, and he was very good at studying and good at researching. And he was a multilingual. He knew the languages, so he could read the originals. And what he did is he went back and found that mathematics was really the starting place. It was number first, and geometry and mechanics. And when we had a good handle on number and geometry and mechanics, only then could we convert astronomy or astrology into astronomy. And only when astronomy was well-rooted could we advance to physics. You just couldn't work physics until you got astronomy. And then the same worked again with chemistry. Until physics was fully in hand, you couldn't go to chemistry. And biology worked the same way. Without chemistry well in hand, you could never get to the next stage, which he called sociology. But they couldn't go from biology to sociology until cerebral physiology was well in hand. And it just happens that it was in hand at the time. And Auguste Comte realized it, and he saw the opportunity to create a new science, and he did. He created sociology.
So this man created the field that really dominates most university thought today.
That's correct. You can't go to a university today without having some of your courses in the humanities or studying the natural sciences. And as sociology spans the entire spectrum and pulls it together, it's not an independent science. The natural sciences are not independent. They're branches from the same trunk as in a tree. Each of the sciences is a specialty, but the specialist may not be aware of what's happening in the other sciences.
So, the pegs in the cog.
Well, pretty much. You know, it's just a job, man. I don't know the other part. I just do this. It's just my job. They're not taught to know. The educational system doesn't want them to know. The division of knowledge is very handy, just like the division of labor is. But we'll get to what he was really going for in his process in a moment. But now that we're starting out here, we need to look at this law that he came up with. Social dynamics, which is part of his law of sociology, is one of the two branches of sociology, is the science of the origin, the history, and the constitution of human society. We're not talking about beating around the edge here. We're talking about an all-encompassing, all-embracing type of a science. And in 1838, when Comte coined the term sociology and becoming its founder, his positive philosophy provided a law of three stages to make historical facts significant. And that's an important phrase. And we'll come to that. We'll come back to that. But here's the first phase, the first stage. In the first stage, the most primitive stage of social development, he called the theological stage. And in the theological stage, men invent gods, as he explained it. He explains the world to himself and builds his belief systems around the supernatural. In the theological stage, man creates the condition which makes a society possible. In the theological stage, tribes form and establish tribal fetishes. However, and this is the important part that I was able to find in his writings, by hypothesizing about gods, man launches the intellectual enterprise which can be started in no other way. And in the theological stage, the priests rule. The priests exchanged eventually many gods for one god. Then, at the period where the priests are ruling, discipline and order are imposed upon the whole community. And authority is vested in the priesthood. Continuing, armies are raised, a military caste arises, boundaries are established. The order of the day is defense and conquest. Warlords and kings begin to emerge. It's a time marked by conquest and dominion. And for an economy, it's basically agricultural labor, whether it be with slavery or bond or free. The community at this time in the theological stage is prosperous. It's happy. It has a common faith and common goals. It yields a very coherent and a strong community. But there's a serpent in the garden. And that's the important thing to remember. That is what brings us to the second stage, which is called the metaphysical stage.
Now, is he characterizing it as having a serpent in the garden? Or?
Yes.
Okay.
The serpent that lies in the garden is endemic. It's inherent, and it can be found in all of the theological societies in the theological stage. In other words, what he's trying to advance here, and I'm convinced that he gave it a good shot, he's trying to identify key things that happen in all of the societies, just as you would if you were studying biology or astronomy. What he's looking for is the material, the works, that you can use to establish the natural laws of sociology. So these are things that are common to all of the societies that are available in the written records. Now, in the metaphysical stage, as man moves forward and progresses, the intellect that invented his God is never content with its creation. That's that serpent that lies there. Because the intellect turns critical, it denatures the divinity into a set of first principles and eternal essences. And you can see that in Aristotle and Plato and Socrates, as they talked about essences and first principles continuously. In the metaphysical stage, the intellect practically deifies itself, the allegiance only to the truths of reason. In the metaphysical stage, authority is challenged. Theological beliefs and institutions come under criticism. Notions such as liberty, equality, fraternity, and popular sovereignty rise, but also slogans can be found in their time. Question authority, free love, down with Big Brother, power to the people, freedom of the soul, right on, right on, hell no, we won't go, workers unite, we the people, add them up. You can know that you're looking at a society that's in the metaphysical stage when you see these various conditions. Additionally, in the metaphysical stage, religion becomes sectarian. It's like the age of inventor religion, or denominations show up every place. The religion isn't held universally. Now, continuing with the attributes of the metaphysical stage, individuals abandon, and I hope we can hear ourselves here somewhere, individuals abandon their social responsibilities. Moral, mental, and political anarchy abounds.
Now, this is his concept of what was happening or will happen?
Will happen in every society.
Okay, by virtue of the study he'd done and seeing this is the nature of how human beings...
That's right, Michael. This is according to Comte, this is the law of three stages by which all societies progress. And once they go through the theological stage, they start to progress into the metaphysical stage, they leave the theological behind, they go into the metaphysical, and this is just what he advanced. And I can find parallel research in the writings of Carol Quigley and many others, that there is an evolution of civilizations, and they follow a line, similar lines. So, he said that in the metaphysical stage, individuals abandon their social responsibilities. Moral, mental, and political anarchy abounds. The disestablishmentarianism flourishes. For instance, the disestablishment of the one holy Catholic and apostolic church, the disestablishment of the concept of the divine right of kings, the disestablishment of a constitutional government, and so on and so on. Revolutions and counter-revolutions can be seen in the people and among the people. Then I added the rise of parliamentarianism. I think that in modern societies, parliamentarian plays a very strong place in the metaphysical stage. Competition with one another for power and control. The love of money. In the metaphysical stage, the peasants drift to the cities, military might declines, and the abstract and the impersonal prepare the minds for the positive stage. And sociologically, the metaphysical stage is a negative moment. It's a time of dissolution and decay. And Comte's research proved that this has happened over and over again in the history of the world. However, it must be noted that historically, no society has ever passed into the metaphysical stage and been saved. However, Western civilization, through the advances in the social sciences and the other technical sciences, Western civilization may now have the means of breaking this cycle.
Now, you're saying that, or he says that?
He says it, and I'm saying it as well.
All right. And his methodology is what's called positivism.
That's right. We're studying Auguste Comte's positivism. And in the positivist mentality and in the positivist program, in the positivist philosophy, libertarian thinking, laissez-faire economics and politics, the industrial, the technical, the high-tech revolutions, and all of the advancements made in the positive sciences, which have made tremendous strides, these are what is going to make possible the progression of the mind of man to move forward from the metaphysical stage for the first time into the positive stage. We haven't experienced a positive stage civilization yet. They generally collapse in the metaphysical stage, go into a complete dark period, come back to the theological stage, collapse, go transition into the metaphysical, and back and back and back. Like they always tell you in school, history has a habit of repeating itself. And Auguste Comte sees that that does not have to happen this time.
Okay.
Now, in this new positive stage that we're coming into, there will be new certainties, because we've thrown away our theological garment. We've thrown away or outgrown the metaphysical arguments, and we move into this positive stage, according to Auguste Comte. And in that positive stage, the positive sciences, astronomy, chemistry, biology, medicine, law, all of the positive sciences provide a certainty which make order possible. However, in the positive stage, there will be a total organization of human life. There will be moral regeneration. Social concerns will become the primary concerns for all, and action will be based on accurate prediction arising from regular law, where again, we're now living love for principle, order for basis, and progress for end. This society has three classes. I was going to make a comment there, Michael, but I'm going to pass. This society has three classes. The upper level, the highest level, the upper class, is the patriciate. The patriciate that is used here harkens back to Roman patricians. So the patriciate here, however, in Auguste Comte's mind, was he viewed it as a managerial class that arose out of industry and finance. Below the patriciate is the priesthood, the positive philosophers. These would be drawn largely from the social sciences. And the third class, and the only remaining class, is the proletariat. And these, in the proletariats cast away their private ambitions and their personal rivalries. They learn. And these are very important words. These aren't words that I've used. These are words I've gleaned from hundreds of pages. They learn to consider all functions as social. They find public utility in the humblest office of cooperation. As the soldier feels in the discharge of his humblest duty, the dignity of public service and the honor of a share in the action of the general economy.
This sounds like the emerging Santa Cruz to me.
You got that right. Comte's aim was to put the study of society on a positive foundation, comparable to those of the natural sciences, and found them, the sciences, not independent, but inseparable, as the branches from the same tree, all of the branches off the same trunk. And so, at that point, or up to this point, we've taken a look at how this concept of this transition from one stage to another is developed in his philosophy. And we see that what he is envisioning is that there are laws that can control this, that dictate it, just as if you were talking about the law of gravity or the law of mechanics or the equal and opposite reactions or the indestructibility of matter. These aren't arbitrary or capricious. These are laws that are discovered inside the study of society. And some of the things that Auguste Comte could never visualize. He would never have been able to perceive the beast computer sitting over there with the barcodes and all the social security numbers and the biometric identifiers. He has no idea, would have had no concept whatsoever of having all of the educational records, the school records, the medical records, the transcripts. He would have no idea of credit card balances and what people buy and when they buy it and what do they buy when it's cold and what do they buy when it's hot and what do they buy when it's 10% off and what do they buy when it's, you know, 20% off and so on and so forth. People will buy socks when they're advertised, when somebody says that the gas prices are going to go up, people all of a sudden buy socks, you know. These things can be tracked and traced. Comte never could envision this, but it's here.
And so what does all that mean for, I mean, positivism sounds like a positive thing, love for principle and progress for an end, you know, order, nobody wants disorder, nobody wants hatred, and nobody wants a lack of progress. But there's something seemingly ominous about this concept, suggests to me, when you hear that the average person is going to learn his social order. It sounds as though he's giving up his self in order to fit in, and that if he doesn't fit in, what happens then?
Well, that's a very good point, because in order to understand this process, we need to know some more of the terms that Auguste Comte came up with. One of the other terms that he came up with was altruism. Comte coined and founded the term altruism, and was himself at once humanitarian and altruist. An altruist advances an unselfish thoughtfulness and regard for the interests of others above his own or his selfish interests. And we'll see when we get to the legal aspects here of just how that can be inculcated or enculturated into the minds of the people. But without knowing that Comte's deepest concern was to preserve the unity and the integrity of man's intellectual pursuits, which he considered threatened to the point of sterility in his day, it's hard to visualize where he was going in his mind. He visioned the development of a new kind of worker, whose task it would be to formulate the principles of the respective sciences and to connect discoveries and known truth. By keeping the whole structure of knowledge in view, these scientific workers would lay a new foundation for education. Now, in the many pages that he devotes to that, what you were seeing, that not everyone is going to get a good education. But wherever someone shows positive tendencies and intellectual ability and characteristics and traits that the controllers, so to speak, found desirable, they would be advanced until they basically disqualified themselves. So we would have a new kind of worker, a super social worker, emerging. And it would be only the super social workers who would have a broad, general, comprehensive understanding of the big picture, who would be able to blend together all of the advances and to ask this think tank to produce something over here, ask this technical group over here to design this, ask this marketing group over here to present it, ask this newspaper agency and this radio and TV station to present this. And it would all be a time delivery program, absolutely seamless.
We certainly see that today. It suggests then, though, that when evaluating children and plucking out those that you seem you think have the right talents and attitudes for a higher level of what really seems to me you're describing a caste society, it leaves all of the others in a as drones in a system that's clearly serving somebody. It always serves the people at the top without giving option to the bulk of the people to become who they are.
That's true. That is exactly right. But again, we have to remember that liberty, fraternity, equality, and those basic human rights are, in his mind, the seeds of anarchy. And that, of course, no one would want to advance themselves above the others, and so everyone will just be happy with the dole that they get. And to reinforce this system, many specialized sociologies will need to be developed, and many have been already. Among those specialized sociologies that he visioned were population, human ecology, rural and urban sociology, the family, the community, the state, religion, law, social classes, caste systems, racial and ethnic groups, social mobility, occupations and professions, criminology, art, knowledge, and education.
Yeah, he talked about all these things?
Yes, mostly.
200 years ago?
Mostly. It's some of the things that are in that particular list I've interpreted, but generally speaking, each of those things are considered under the specialized sociologies. Again, these are the specialized, a new kind of worker who will address these issues. But they might be, these topics may be spread over 50 or 60 pages of reading.
Now, you talked, I need to go back and clarify, the idea of patriciate, which is the, you know, the elite class, the ruling class, it comes from what classes of people, what groupings of people?
Well, what Comte advanced in his Positive Politics was a society based upon this principle. He advocated a dictatorship exercised by those wielding power. That's a two-sided sword. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah.
On the one hand, you have a dictator, but on the other, it's exercised by those wielding power, so there's a shadow government. The best life in Comte's Positive Politics rests upon the fullest knowledge. So for those that are given the most advancement in understanding and knowledge, they would live the best life. Central and intellectual moral authorities would be established. You might call that the CIA and the FBI. In Comte's plan, he looked at an organized spiritual power. You might consider that to be Reverend Moon, or perhaps the World Council of Churches, or the new United Nations religion. He envisioned or state-sponsored philosophers, which you might think as MIT or Brookhaven or Brookings or all of the various and sundry think tanks. In addition to that, Auguste Comte was looking at putting the temporal power in the hands, and this answers your question, in the hands of the captains of industry, checked by moral responsibility, only by the spiritual power. These would be experts, bankers, industrialists, intellectuals, and entrepreneurs.
Well, certainly, as we see sustainable development lay out and the movement toward a one world order, guided by or managed by international organizations, that's exactly how it is. Now, was he so omnipotent that he could foresee this, or has the world taken his concepts and worked to achieve them for somebody else's own end?
Well, Auguste Comte gets a pretty unfair shake, in my opinion, in that regard. If you look in the encyclopedias as I've done it and go to the libraries and look him up, you'll almost not find him anywhere. That's largely because he came up with his idea of a religion. But if I were to suggest to you, for instance, that it would be really nice to have a light bulb, and perhaps I would even give you an idea of what the light bulb might look or how it might work, and then go away and never bother you again. If you then went on and invented the light bulb, you could get all of the credit for it. Auguste Comte didn't work out all the details. He was a generalist, a super generalist, and he basically put out this palette, these brushstrokes. But it's been from these brushstrokes that many, many, many other men have written. And one of his closest disciples, John Stuart Mill, when he was...
You always think of him as a
utilitarian.
Utilitarian,
Jeremy Bentham, Austin, all of these guys over in England. You don't think of him as positivist, but he was most certainly a positivist. But when John Stuart Mill saw, and Littre, L-I-T-T-R-E, when these two men saw Auguste Comte's catechism of the positive religion, they could take no more. They could see it all. They could not only see a whole system of control of society, a system of basically just a chain around the people, but then when he went in and started going for their hearts and their minds, the men couldn't, Mill couldn't take it. He went back to England and he started writing Contra Comte. He started writing against it. He wrote On Liberty, one of the first that he wrote. It was like as a response, a reaction to the shock from Comte's writings.
When people came to understand the dynamic that this leads to, it strikes me as totalitarianism in the sense that that there's a narrow elite that promises a utopian life for the masses so long as they don't develop themselves as human beings.
Well, it's certainly an aristocracy or the rule by the best, to say the least, or perhaps to say the worst. But the way that we need to see how this translates into today is not so much, in my opinion, Comte's writings. They were like a framework. They were a skeleton. They were the springboard. They were the place that said, see, look here, see. But you can't find him anywhere. But you can find Karl Marx. You can find the Fabian socialists. You can find this group and that group. You can find this group and that group, this philosophy, that philosophy. But underlying it all, like a hum or a drone, the drone string in Indian music or something, or in Celtic music, underneath it all is Auguste Comte's system of positivism. So you can call it anything you want. Raise up any ism that you want, but his system has been working steadily. And why? Because it's in the schools. He envisioned a new form of education, and that education has altered. John Dewey was a positivist. John Dewey's writings I've read, gone through, and I've read his book on democracy, and as far as I'm concerned, he probably went to sleep with Comte's books on his bed table. There are many people that are like that. Before I knew about positivism, before it came to my knowledge, I had no clue. But as soon as I knew, then I started to see. I went back through all of my philosophy books and through my encyclopedias, and Comte started showing up in one-liners everywhere.
Very interesting. Ideas and philosophers do have effects on societies as time marches forward.
That's right, they do, Michael. And let's take a look at how this is being rolled out on us and at us today from the standpoint of law. You know, if we look at law, and I know this is a long story, and I'm doing a lot of reading, and I'm probably boring the audience, but I hope they'll call in and bug us if they have some questions.
Yes, but if you have a question or a comment, you can call us at 888-24-LIBERTY. And we do have a caller on the line. No, we don't. Okay, proceed.
Okay. Law, it could be summed up in just a few words as a command. Law is a command that is backed up by threat and force. And in legal positivism, it alters it. First, we have to understand legal, and you could go through a whole study of that. You can go through the whole study of law. But you put in this word positivism, and then you invoke Comte's law of three stages, and you invoke Comte's philosophy. So just by merging it with the word positivism, it alters everything. So legal positivism is the theory that legal rules are valid only because they are enacted by an existing political authority or accepted as binding in a given society, not because they are grounded in morality or in natural law. So this has been known for a long time. And it's been described in various ways. Back in Justinian's Digest, Justinian, it's the time of Rome, he has in his Digest, he says, what pleases the prince has the force of law. Whatever pleases the prince has the force. It's not a law, it has the force of law. Another way of looking at it is whatever is enacted by the law-making agency is the law in the society. Or, as John Austin, contemporary with Comte, said, the existence of law is one thing, its merit or demerit is another. So we can see in the rollout of legal positivism that what we're dealing with is a government of measures and not a government of laws.
Yeah, a government of control over people. There is a caller, Tim from Indianapolis. Tim, are you with us?
Oh, hi, gentlemen. Yes, you know, I'm over here in Indiana, and like almost 12 o'clock, and, you know, this new world order here, and I'm a 45-year-old man, and I'm feeling paranoid here, you know, guys, thinking about this new world order. How are we going to stop it? Dr. Yates, you mentioned Bush. You don't know if he's Wilson or Roosevelt. Maybe he's both, because there's a correlation with Wilson, his League of Nations, and Bush is a UN man. And Roosevelt, you know, there was some hanky-panky at Pearl Harbor and then 9/11. But my question, last week or so, we had this Nazi-like raid, local, federal, national officers making sweeps across our country, kicking in doors, called Operation Falcon. You know, to me, that puts up a red flag. And what do you consider? What would you make a comment on that? I'm sure we got to arrest criminals, but that type of, as opposed to arresting these illegal aliens making some raids on some illegals, no, we're going after our Americans.
Well, as the broadcast, if I may respond, as the broadcast proceeds, we'll touch on some of that. But let's just go back to where that particular problem, has its origin. There are several different things that are going on there. But first of all, if you'll go back and look at the Patriot Act 1 and 2, basically what they did was they used the trick of legal positivism and logical positivism to sidestep and circumvent the constitutional provisions that you believe that you have to protect you. And by being able to sidestep them, they can do the big sweeps. The big sweeps have been done repeatedly in history. They rounded up all the Jesuits in one evening. They rounded up Templars in one evening in France. They rounded up Jews in an evening. They rounded up any number of Christians in an evening. Sweeps and big sweeps are not unusual in history. But in the United States of America, prior to this generation, that would have been anathema to the entire system. It flew directly in the face of our Constitution, and the people would not allow it. But as the broadcast continues, you'll see the tools that are necessary to make that happen. And as you've demonstrated, those tools are in effect.
Yeah, Tim, I think you hit right on a point that proves the philosophical transformation that is happening with our government as a result of what we're learning to be legal positivism. And proceed, Will, in explaining how legal positivism affects how it is we're living today and how it affects the application and interpretation of law. I mean, you've told us already that positivism, as I understand you, that legal positivism means that the law is whatever they say the law is.
That's right, Michael. Whatever is enacted by the lawmaking agency is the law in the society.
Well, that sounds like the Santa Cruz County Planning Department and planning departments around this country.
That is exactly what I was going to get to, is that when you go into these local unelected boards, when you get the gentleman that was on the broadcast, I believe it was last week, who found himself in a meeting in one state or county, and he was going to battle for his personal property rights against an ordinance that had been brought forward, and he discovered that there was another person from another state that had exactly the same wording on another ordinance that impacted their community. We can see how this is all being used together, on us and at us, and it has very, very little to do with what the people want in their community. This is a force coming from above to below.
We have another caller, Rick from Texas. Rick? Rick, are you with us?
Yeah. Hear me?
Well, yeah, speak up a little bit, please.
Okay, there were a couple of ad breaks during y'all's conversation, so the shortwave listeners didn't get to hear what three steps were. We heard the theological, then the metaphysical reaction against that, but I didn't hear the last one of his three steps to society.
Okay, would you like me to answer that, Michael?
Yes.
All right. There are the three laws, or the three stages of the development of the society. And the first one was the theological. The second one is a transition point where you move into the metaphysical. And the third one, which we haven't gotten to yet in human history, is the positive. And the positive has certain other attributes that are not found in the prior two. But as we move more into the positive, right now in the West, we are coming to a threshold where we, the West, might be able to move into the positive. Unfortunately, in the haste of the leadership in the world today, there is a great portion of the world that are still in the theological and the early stages of the metaphysical. The question is, how will we deal with them? Are we just going to destroy them? Or will we stand back and let them follow the natural law of the societies and develop at their own pace? That's a big question.
And for you listeners out there, if you've missed some part of the show, we do archive these shows, and we have them available on CD for purchase. Go to freedom21santacruz.net/radio and or call us at 831-684-2232. So let's proceed on, and thank you for your call.
Okay, Michael, we brought up, the caller brought up the constitutional issue, so let's go into it and put this in American jurisprudence. In Blackstone's commentaries, I read where it says that human laws are of no validity if they are contrary to the laws of God. Now, if Blackstone's commentaries is, and most certainly was, the cornerstone of early American jurisprudence, then that shows very definitely a theological stage of the three stages, perhaps a theological stage moving into the metaphysical stage. But positivism denies the existence of the metaphysical as well as absolutes in general. And so John Austin, the same man that wrote The Existence of Law is One Thing, Its Merit or Demerit is Another, John Austin wrote and concluded that to proclaim generally that all laws which are pernicious or contrary to the will of law of God are void and not to be tolerated is to preach anarchy. Austin castigated Blackstone for having mischievously abused language. And we must remember that it was Auguste Comte who was the abolition of anarchy was the foremost in Auguste Comte's system. So when Austin is castigating Blackstone for having mischievously abused language, that leads us into and away from legal positivism to the next phase. Trouble always comes in threes. Comte provides threes. The next phase is logical positivism. And in logical positivism, it too is a philosophical and linguistic system or movement, and it was founded in part by Rudolf Carnap and Karl Hempel. They were considered the core unit of the Vienna Circle, Vienna, Austria. And in logical positivism, it requires that meaningful statements be in principle verifiable. Now let's go back up and see how logical positivism impacts Blackstone's comment. Again, Blackstone said, human laws are of no validity if they are contrary to the laws of God. Now, if you found yourself in an argument with a positivist, a logical positivist, at a meeting or in writings or some kind of a political environment...
One of the Soviet Council members.
What that person's going to do is he's going to marginalize you. And so what we're going to do is we're not going to focus our attention on human laws. We're not going to discuss whether human laws are valid. What we're going to concentrate on is that they're contrary to the laws of God. And so the first thing, and the only thing I really need to do, is to ask you where your God gave you those laws. And so then you'll proceed to tell him about the Ten Commandments and this and that. And basically, he's just going to marginalize you. You cannot verify that statement. It's a principle of belief. It's a principle of attitude. And I'm sorry, that just is not going to fly. And to prove that that's the case, they took the Ten Commandments out. So, in a nutshell, logical positivism finds all of the philosophers and the theologians of the past as mere muddleheads. It reduces all of our writing to a system of logical symbology, and you should see it written out. It's incredible. But it has so altered our language in America that bleats and grunts pass for presidential discourse. Now, I went to some school board meetings in our county here at the high school and had the opportunity to go into the high school library. That's where they hold the meetings in the evening. And I looked on the philosophy shelves, and I saw no philosophy books. But what I did see in the high school library were books on shamanism and on witchcraft and on spiritual stuff and occult stuff, but nothing for the classical philosophy at all, not even present. I went to our county library, two, maybe three books on philosophy. The rest of it, spiritualism, occultism, all kinds of stuff, shamanism, how to be a witch, how to do this, how to do that, Harry Potter and all the like. Harry Potter in the philosophy section. So logical positivism is the way that the linguistics, or the words, how our words work together. Here's another good logical positive statement. Everyone will remember the sound bites on shortwave when Donald Rumsfeld was being asked about going into Iraq without us finding any weapons of mass destruction or destruction. And he made a remark back that was very unusual. It was carried all over the shortwave. But it went along something along the lines of this. He says, there are things that we know. There are things that we don't know. There are the things that we know that we know. There are the things that we don't know that we know. There are the known knowns, and there are the unknown knowns. There's the unknown unknowns, and there's the, and it just continued. And everybody laughed. But if you listen to it, and listen to it very carefully, you'll see that he was schooled somewhere along the line and became an adept, a high priest, if you will, of logical positivism.
Wow. Now, we have another caller from Pacific Grove here on the Central Coast, Troy. Troy, are you with us?
Yes, I'm still laughing from the last one there. I just want to thank you for coming on to the show tonight. And it's just been a pleasure to listen to a man that has his knowledge well ordered. One question, can you explain how this present administration is using Conte and Machiavelli so effectively? And two, have you ever studied a French philosopher by the name of Ramus? And I'll just listen on the air. Thank you.
All right. I'll respond to that. The last philosopher, I may not have studied. I would have to see the name. Not everyone pronounces things the same way. Auguste Comte is actually Auguste Comte. But in how is our government right now, this administration, using legal positivism and logical positivism leads us to the last stage, and we are running short of time. And so the last stage is logical positive realism. Now you'll recognize this immediately, because logical positive realism goes beyond words and phrases, and it focuses on thoughts, on beliefs, on attitudes, and on feelings, and other areas that are more obtuse, things that are not verifiably present. It's not necessarily our senses. This stage of positivism is going into your mind and looking at things in there. We have the mental health screening. We're going to go into your mind and examine the contents of your mind. We're going to ask you about your mommy and your daddy. We're going to ask you about your religion. We'll ask you about your belief systems. We'll ask you about all your faith. Now, they're not just curious. They intend to use that, and they intend to use that information to their own ends. That's what you get with the assessment profiles, the MAP test, I think it's called Missouri Assessment Program, where they test the children. And they're not testing the children to find out whether they know where Denver is, or what the capital of Alaska is, or, you know, the Juneau, or whatever. They're not interested in that. What they're interested in is to see whether or not the students are absorbing the information. They're trying to find out whether the attitudes and the beliefs are following along. They want to find out whether or not the children understand that this is a constitutional democracy, which I've actually seen in the material, in the literature that I have on the MAP test. To ask questions like that is leading the children into ignorance, leading them away from the truth. And the government basically is able to use this. Look at the image. Look at the image that Karl Rove and the media have crafted to make Bush look like an absolute buffoon. He may not be. He may be a wolf in sheep's clothing. But when he comes on the cameras, when he's up in front of the people, he fumbles and falls all over himself. And so all of the men who have been conditioned by the television, they feel comfortable with their inadequacy, and the Bush is inadequate, and the administration don't know the answers. And, oh, well, we just made another mistake. It's reinforcing the picture. Visualize the picture, project into the future, reinforce it at all levels, start at the education, take it up through school, the social, the clubs, organizations, take it into the magazines, take it to the cinema. It's a complete closed loop. And what it strives to do is it strives to social engineer towards an end or an end goal that you or I have no idea. It plans, it computes, it executes our daily reality. It's like a time-release vitamin pill. Every needed grain is carefully released for the maximum cumulative effect. The specialists don't all know their part, but they know that it all fits together, and fit it does. Legislation today, it's like the old Johnny Carson show, Carnac. He takes the envelope, taps it up on his head, and he tells you the answer to the question. He opens it up, he reads the question. Legislation comes through today just like that. It's brought forward by some sustainable agenda, you know, development group, some environmental bunch of weenals, or somebody that's against the animals that wants the salamander protected, or worse, it comes through in the form of the Patriot Act. And it comes through and it's presented into the committee. The envelope's never even opened. The committee chairman holds up the envelope and says, House Bill 2516, all those in favor say aye. They say aye. It's passed out of committee, goes to the floor. House Bill 2516, he taps his head. All in favor say aye, they say aye, and it goes out. They take the same envelope, they run it over to the Senate, then they run it up through the Senate committees, back down on the floor, and finally they take it right over to the President. And the President is the first person that opens the bill. He opens up the envelope, takes out the top page, and the top page only, that's the page he signs. The photo op happens, he slides the page back in, the bill is now law, and no one's read it.
Yeah, except the guy who wrote it in the back room, and who knows who that person was, right?
Or which back room or in which nation it's being written. As we're outsourcing everything today, there's no reason to expect that we're not outsourcing our legislation.
Well, I can tell you, Joan Peros here in Santa Cruz, who goes to a lot of the UN conferences, was at the environmental conference, and she got there a prototype environmental bill. When she got home 2 weeks later, the governor of California at that time, it was Gray Davis, signed the same bill. Now, that bill was being promoted by the UN, and it was passed here in California within 2 weeks. So the prototypes come from elsewhere, and your example is funny, and it's beautiful. We're just about out of time, Will, and I want to say thank you very much. This show has been so informative. You ended it with a flurry and a flash there, and I look forward to the next time we talk. If you miss some part of the show and you want to get it, contact us at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. If you're not receiving our report, which comes out periodically, sometimes every week, tell us about the show, give a call, and we'll let you know.
Views expressed on tonight's Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show are the opinions of neither this station nor its sponsors. In fact, they're not necessarily the opinions of Radio Liberty or of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. The views expressed by the host are those of the host. Also, the opinions expressed by callers and guests are theirs. Whether you agree or disagree, please join in. To participate, you can call during caller segments at 888 888-245-4234-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. Or you can go to our online audience participation center at www.freedom21santacruz.net/radio. That's freedom21santacruz.net/radio. Now let's start advancing freedom.
Well, welcome to this evening's edition of the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. I'm Michael Shaw. I'm here with my co-host, Roy Avila. Good evening, Roy.
Good evening, Michael. How are you?
Well, I'm excited. Tonight we're going to have a double-packed show. The first hour, we're going to delve back into the philosophical roots that really are governing and guiding our society today, not roots that many people understand and fewer people would support if they understood it. And then in the second hour, we're going to get down to the practical application. We're going to talk about habitat conservation plans, just another one of those strange applications of the Endangered Species Act that is wreaking such havoc upon American society and on private property specifically all across the nation. But to move along into our first hour, you know, tonight it's the continuing exposé on how positivist philosophy of Auguste Comte drives sustainable development. We're going to have a first-time guest, Mrs. Erica Carl, who will demonstrate how positivism accounts for the modern philosophical origins of the environmental movement, how it is really shaping the reordering of the family dynamic, and how it is the central idea for causing a centralization of economic and political power. We call it public-private partnerships, and so much more. You know, if we don't have an understanding of positivist philosophy and the origins of that through the philosopher Auguste Comte back in the early 19th century, we really will miss how it is that today's society is being driven. Our guest, Erica Carl, is an independent researcher and writer. She has a bachelor's degree from the University of Wisconsin. She's taught math and composition at private schools in Wisconsin. For 10 years, she wrote a weekly column called Truth in Education for the Wisconsin Report. And she served as editor for education editor for that publication. Her books are Give Us the Young, Why Things Are the Way They Are, and a loose-leaf collection of quotes entitled Six Generations to Serfdom. She's a writer who publishes at News with Views, and she had an article published on October 17th entitled Shaping Your Future, Whether You Like It or Not. Erica, are you with us? We don't have Erica up on the phone line yet. But
well, while we're trying to get a hold of her, you know, you were sharing with me before we got on this evening, some of the things that were in this article, which, when you were sharing them with me, it was almost scary how the writings of that time, what this guy was doing, is exactly what we talk about on this program and what's going on right now.
Well, it is. I mean, the subjects about which Auguste Comte has written about is the life and the policy that we live with all the time today. Erica is with us. Erica, we've made an introduction of you to the audience with your background as a writer and educator, and welcome to the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show this evening.
Thank you.
Well, it's going to be a pleasure, and I'm excited to hear the replays of this show myself once we're done here tonight. You know, you write, how can shaping the future be so easy? Auguste Comte, who lived from 1798 to 1857, is the father of sociology and the religion of humanity. We're going to be right back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show.
Okay.
We're back while some stations take a commercial break with Erica Carl, our guest, and continuing with the quote from your recent writing on Auguste Comte, you say that he devoted his entire intellectual life to plans for shaping the future.
Right.
He published a six-volume Positive Philosophy, and then he wrote his four-volume System of Positive Polity, more of a political application, and then his, which was four volumes, and then he wrote his Catechism of the Positive Religion, which capped off his career, in order to instruct his followers about the methods to shape the future.
Yes.
So, boy, we have done shows on August Comte, and tell us more, and tie some of the quotes that that you have dredged up from the past, and show us how they apply to our society today.
Okay. Well, Comte lived from 1798 to 1857, and during the time of his youth, things had changed quite a bit. The Catholic Church in France had lost quite a bit of its power. Science was making great strides, and people were getting more conveniences, and life was getting better. Comte said, "This was all wonderful. However, we're going to have to get control of things again." And he reasoned out that in order to get control of people and of government and of the future, he would have to first get control of science. And in order to get control of science, he originated his own, what he called a new science, sociology, or social science, he called it. Then he wanted to get control of religion. And in order to get control of religion, he decided that he would form his own new religion, which he called the religion of humanity. His teacher, Saint Simon, had called it humanitarianism. If you look at very much older dictionaries, you'll find that humanitarianism, which sometimes even Christian ministers are happy to be called humanitarian, but the original definition of humanitarianism is the doctrine that denies the divinity of Christ. Did you know that?
No, I didn't, but I would presume that Auguste Comte would also want to deny the spiritual base of any of the world's major religions.
Yes, well, he was raised Catholic, and he disappointed his parents considerably when he went to the Yes.
We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show with our guest, Erica Carl, and we're talking about the background of Auguste Comte as he... was raised and became an adult in the early 19th century.
And we said he wanted to get control of science and religion in order to control people and the future. And to control science, he invented sociology or social science, and to control religion, he invented his own religion of humanity. And he figured that people who believed in God would eventually all get together in one great Catholic Church. Those who didn't believe in God would follow his humanitarian religion, and eventually, over the generations, they would merge and we'd have a one-world religion.
So a one-world religion controlled by...
sociology.
New science and sociology controlling
right.
Those sciences.
He was a brilliant man. In fact, some of the things that write about him say that he wrote whole books, he worked it out in his mind, and then he just sat down and wrote from beginning to end. He was probably, he was a mathematician, really, and probably a genius at organizing thoughts about how to control the future, and he covered every subject. I collected a lot of these quotes, and I said, many believe the moral and educational deterioration of recent generations just happened, but research shows the decline was planned and executed intentionally. The goal is a totally managed world dictatorship to replace constitutional government and national sovereignty.
Now, did Comte address those issues?
Oh, absolutely. I divided my quotes into 14 different divisions, and these are the things that have to be accomplished in order to take over. I'm not saying there are only 14, but I have quotes from Comte to start out the first generation, and then I go through six generations, and it's six generations to serfdom. The first thing he had to do was replace Christianity with a positive religion. Abolish monarchy. The third, institute and expand communistic principle. The fourth, limit education and establish sociological control. The fifth, and here's where you've been very interested, control the environment to control mankind and claim the land. Sixth, destroy moral authority and crush personality. Seventh, control public opinion. And he said that the public opinion had to be shaped and controlled, and that the world would be directed by public opinion. The eighth was liberalize sexual attitudes and behavior. The ninth, destroy the natural family and diminish the male role. Tenth, establish evolutionary theory and control sciences.
Now pause for just a minute. I think the listener ought to reflect on these first ten and ask themselves, so certainly if they're a regular listener of Freedom 21, if they have heard elements of the application of each of these concepts in the real world of today.
It's all there. And, you know, people get, the sociological types get all upset when you talk about creation or evolution. Well, the reason for this is because sociology is based on what they call cultural evolution. And Comte felt that evolution was part of the basic principle, and he needed biological evolution in order to have something to base it on. And should I go on with the
Yes, go on
last
with the remainder.
Promote global integration. Invest political power in the wealthy and industrial leaders.
And today we call that public-private partnership.
Yeah. Establish cities as humanity's centers of operation.
And that's called smart growth.
Yeah, that's true. Replace the Constitution with a world management system.
And that's called the United Nations.
Right. And all of these things he carried out and told people how to handle it. And there were followers of Comte who gave their instructions in the next generation and the next generation and the next generation. And today, look at sociology. It's in every college and every high school.
Well, and I like to say that our whole secondary academic institution within America has really just become a Comtean academic experience. You go in with fresh ideas and you come out a sociologist, and that's whether you are dealing in physical sciences or majoring in maybe almost anything but accounting.
Well, accounting was probably closest to what he was a mathematician, so they probably get something there too.
Well, as we move to this concept of triple bottom line accounting, which is being pushed by some serious accountants around this country, we begin to find that even accounting is afflicted by the Comtean disease.
Well, you know, in order to realize the goal of a world management system, you have to get the cooperation of people, whether it's ignorant or knowledgeable cooperation. And this is one thing they learned at Harvard. If you're going to make changes, the best way to do it and to get cooperation is get the people involved in the change to assist in making the change. And many people don't realize how their involvement through some of the organizations they join and give sanction for them to be represented, how they are helping bring about this management system.
Well, in my conversations with you, you pointed out one glaring example of that, at least glaring in my mind, and that was the Chamber of Commerce.
We would not have a United Nations if it weren't the Chamber of Commerce.
Well, explain
and
that, please.
The Chamber of Commerce wanted the United Nations because there's an Economic and Social Council within the United Nations. And the Economic and Social Council has consultants from what they call NGOs. NGOs are non-governmental organizations. And it's getting to the point these non-governmental organizations, the Chamber of Commerce, U.S. Chamber of Commerce, I should say, being one of the primary ones. And they consult with the United Nations and tell the United Nations what they think should be done. The United Nations makes it a world policy. It communicates that to the legislators of the various countries, and the Chamber of Commerce is an extremely, extremely powerful organization. Then Washington passes legislation that conforms to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce demands or requests, and oftentimes the local members of the Chamber of Commerce don't like what's coming forth. They have no idea that it was their own organization through the United Nations that promoted it, because it comes around indirectly. It's a nice setup for the world government promoters, because they can promote these things and be anonymous about it.
Well, it really is an application, isn't it, of the consensus process. It's really a higher tier application of the Delphi technique. Is that a fair statement?
I think so. I think so. You know, when they set up these local meetings for sustainable development, and I've attended quite a few of them, they always are looking for consensus. It's actually sometimes kind of fun to go to these meetings, because they can have 100 or 150 people there, and if they're sincere and looking for consensus, one person can ruin the whole thing, because if everybody doesn't agree, they don't have consensus. So sometimes they'll just break up the meeting and say, well, we'll schedule our next meeting for such and such and hope they can do better the next time. But one person can get in the way of the whole thing.
Well, we've certainly disclosed and discovered many examples in that mode, and of course, if that doesn't make sense to the listener, the best way to begin to understand that is read Bev Ekman's workbook called Understanding Group Manipulation and How to Counter It.
Well, that sounds like a good one.
You know, it's beautiful. It's about a 70-page handbook, and it'll describe what they do, how they do it, why they do it, what their goals are, and how it is that you can take this phony consensus process off its track. And it really is just by not falling prey to the group manipulation, the public opinion that Comte was so foresighted in understanding how to create a group mentality and how to use public opinion to monitor, guide, and really direct public action. And if you see through that and get down to the truth and the reason of what's going on, simply by asking reasoned questions, you can throw this phony and contrived consensus process off track. And every county in the country is going through this dynamic now, and that's why understanding group manipulation tactics becomes
and
so
you wonder
important.
How you wonder sometimes how can it show up in every country, in every county, and all over the country at the same time, not only all over our country but other countries that are doing the same thing. And when you realize how powerful is the Chamber of Commerce, and how often, I would say, Chamber of Commerce people are usually involved in setting up these meetings, you can begin to understand how it can be a worldwide situation.
Well, I think that's a beautiful application of taking what they always said in the 80s here in Santa Cruz, the global to local dynamic, and how it's been made to come true. And, you know, here in Santa Cruz, there's no question that the Chamber of Commerce's in our communities have been major players in doing that. We're going to be right back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show with our special guest, Erica Carl. We're back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz with our guest, Erica Carl, as we continue through the breakaway for some of our stations while they do some advertising. And let's just continue the conversation, Erica.
Before we move on, Erica, this is Roy Avila. You said something earlier about what was going on at Harvard. You know, Harvard, for many folks in this country, is one of the most respected institutions of higher learning. What went on and what's going on at Harvard?
Well, Harvard, for one thing, they tell people how to adjust for the change or how to get people to adjust for the change. But another thing that Harvard has is what's called the Harvard Management System. And starting in the 1940s, top executives from many of the largest corporations went to Harvard. I think it was a six-week training course, and they would learn this Harvard Management System. And the difference between what happened with the Harvard Management System and what the way things used to be, in the Harvard Management System, you're managing the men. Used to be, if you had a business, you managed your business. But it was definitely management of men. And when I've written various articles about the Harvard Management System, I usually abbreviate it with HAR for Harvard Management System. So I call it the HARMS system. Mm-hmm. And that makes sense, too. But there's a big difference between managing your business and trying to manage the people and their lives.
Well, managing men or managing people is the essence of seeking control over people. And I've always thought that there's nothing really more rotten than the effort to take control of the life of someone else. And that's really what we end up with the philosophy of positivism, is it not?
That's right. That was the total intent. The first thing that brought me to Kant, I was researching another person. It was actually Edward Bellamy. And it mentioned he wrote the book Looking Backward, which was a fictional design for a perfect socialistic system that was going to take place in the year 2000. And how Bellamy had been strongly influenced by reading Comte. And I thought, well, I've got to find out who this August Comte is. And I went to my older editions of the Encyclopedia Britannica. It was the 14th edition, which was about 1906. And in that it said, this is a quote from Comte, "In the name of the past and of the future, the servants of humanity, both its philosophical and its practical servants, come forward to claim as their due the general direction of the world. Their object is to constitute at length a real providence in all departments, moral, intellectual, and material. Consequently, they exclude once for all from political supremacy all the different servants of God, Catholic, Protestant, or deist, as being at once behindhand and a cause of disturbance." And the whole article gave a great deal about Comte's life and his goals, and actually, it would have been enough to convince me.
Excuse me, Erica. We're back at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show for Stations of the Broken Away. With Erica Carl, and for the last few minutes we've been talking about how positivism, the philosophy of positivism, is the attempt to control all human action. And Erica has quoted Comte's vision in that regard, his vision for shaping the future of today, and she's referred to the author Bellamy, his first name I forgot.
Edward Bellamy.
Edward Bellamy in his book Looking Backward. Now Bellamy, of course, was a very famous and one of the first Fabians in America, all of whom my early research seems to indicate were drawn to Comte and his philosophy. So to the extent we have political action surviving today through people like Tony Blair, the past chairman of the Fabian Socialist Society, we've got a political action organization that is rooted in the philosophy of August Comte, and just gives us another reason to be concerned about understanding what positivist philosophy is and where it came from and how it's affecting us today as this grand change that teachers talk about.
From the 1890s on, Bellamy's book, Looking Backward, was extremely popular. And being a fictionalized version, it was designed to affect the emotions of the reader. And it sold all over the world. And after the book came out, there were Bellamy clubs formed throughout the world. And one of the people who lectured on Edward Bellamy was Annie Besant of the Theosophical Society. And there's another person, I don't know how much you've talked about Madame Blavatsky and the Theosophical Society, but Madame Blavatsky was extremely much influenced by what Comte wrote. And part of the doctrines that she used to set up her society come from Comte and the ideas she got from Comte.
Erica, this is Roy Avila again. Who was Comte influenced by?
A philosopher named Saint-Simon, for one. And I think there was one called Condorcet. And, you know, you can go back farther and farther and farther. And I haven't really gone back that much into those people, because Comte gave me everything I needed to understand what was going on today.
Was there anything in your research, was there anything that happened in his life, or, you know, because usually when you read about these people, something happens to them, then they react in a certain way to move in
the
right direction.
Well, you know, he was born right after the French Revolution, and there was probably quite a bit of talk against the Catholic Church, and the Catholic Church was losing power. He decided he was much too smart to be a member of the Church, and he thought that he could invent a much better religion. Now, he thought of his religion as, with all the system of the Catholic Church, but he wanted to get rid of this Jesus fellow. So, in his mind, the religion of humanity was Catholicism without Jesus.
Concept being a universal church, the meaning
that's
of
right,
Catholic.
Universal church.
Yes.
And that was the same concept that Blavatsky had and the followers of her side.
Well,
it's a big complicated thing, but I find it easier to understand what was going on as soon as I found Comte, and it's a tree with a lot of branches, and you can hang things on every different branch, and they all are related to each other, and you can understand how they can cover so much territory.
And he had a comprehensive system to include a comprehensive management of humanity.
Well, now, each of those books of the Positive Polity is, I think the least is probably about 400 pages. I would say they're at least 2,000 pages of instructions how to set up the system. And then he also had that religion of positive religion catechism. And early he got a lot of followers through the system of, through the positive philosophy. So he had plenty of instruction for those intellectuals who wanted to read all his volumes and figure out how to do things.
Wow.
I think maybe the top sociologists now have access to the volumes, but they aren't easy to find.
Well, he's certainly not taught much in colleges today.
No, I took a sociology course. They never told me who originated it.
My. We're going to be right back at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show, and when we do, we're going to talk about Comte and environmentalism and what influence that may be having today. We'll be right back.
You might be wondering if Freedom 21 Santa Cruz is a liberal or a conservative organization. Are they left or right, Republican or Democrat? But you'll find that none of these one-dimensional labels applies to Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, nor to many of its participants. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz dialogue doesn't take place in a left-right, liberal-conservative dialectic, but on a spectrum between liberty and tyranny. Freedom 21 Santa Cruz participants include people from all political parties, religions, races, and backgrounds who are united in the pursuit of individual liberty and the protection of our U.S. Constitutional Republic. To find out how you can donate to or participate in Freedom 21 Santa Cruz, please log on to freedom21santacruz.net or call 831-684-2232.
We're back here before some of our stations return with us to continue our discussion with Erica Carl on August Compte. For the listening audience, probably what, a 15-page summary of some classic quotes from August Compte and his various volumes is available to you if you go into our radio page. That's f21sc.net/radio. You can have a link to the article that was recently published by Erica, and it is a breathtaking read. I mean, you just if you're familiar at all with what's really underlying sustainable development and its movements that are cross-cutting our society, and read what Compte wrote nearly 200 years ago. You know, it may not be taught to the average sociology student, but boy, somebody is reading this stuff, and that somebody is taking these words to their natural conclusion and is bringing us this this massive change in our society and around the world. You want to check out these quotes that Erica has compiled and has published in a recent article.
I think you'll find the one that I have first on the group that I sent to you. Environment controls mankind. In order to regulate or combine mankind, religion must in the first instance place man under the influence of some external power, possessed of superiority so irresistible as to leave no uncertainty about it. The great principle of sociology, of social science, is at bottom merely...
Hold that thought for a second, Erica. We'll be right back. We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz Radio Show. I'm Michael Shaw with Roy Avila, and we're talking with Erica Carl on the positivist philosophy of August Compte and its influence on today's society. And she's explaining how Compte's vision was that environment controls mankind, and that mankind needs the influence of an external power. In history, it had always been theology, and I think you're getting to the point where you're going to say he proposes that what controls mankind is the environment?
The great principle, he said, of social science is at bottom merely the full development of the primary notion of sound biology, the necessary subordination of every organism to the environment in which it is placed. A sound theory of biology thus furnishes the positive theory of religion with a foundation wholly unassailable, for it proves the general necessity for the constant supremacy of an external power as a condition for the unity of man, even in his individual life. So you see why evolution was so important to the sociologist.
Well, you know, you said this guy was brilliant, and it's just amazing to read that and, you know, think about how long ago that was written and how it is exactly what's going on today.
Yes, and you, I'll read you some of the headlines I put on the quotes. Earth belongs to the great being. Human species and the animal races, the animal rights movement was predicted way back then, or not predicted, projected, I suppose you could say.
Called for, in essence.
It's kind of a futurism, what he wrote. Human species relations with the animal races. The worship of plants to be restored. There you have your tree huggers. The sociological spirit has to be supreme, and that means supreme over all the other sciences.
And sociological spirit, what, means altruism, that you live your life for others, that you're really an object of community's use?
Well, he invented the word altruism, I guess you know that.
Yes.
And, altruism means otherism, means that you don't think of yourself, you always think of others.
And what that really allows is for the ruling master to take control of you, because after all, your individualism's been crushed and your use is only evident if you're sacrificial to the common good.
And total interference of everybody with everybody else's life.
Okay.
One of the important things is sociology is supposed to be the disciplinarian of science, and actually direct science what to do and where to go, and be the master science over all of the other sciences. And I don't know how other scientists in other fields can allow this to happen, and allow sociology to be in a college without a protest. I can't understand it.
Funding,
that's for sure. And it was the Rockefeller money that did a lot to build up sociology, especially in University of Chicago, where they started. And it wasn't until pretty well into the 19th century, I mean the 20th century, that sociology got into most of the colleges. And it was a struggle for them, but as soon as the money started coming, then they all started classes in sociology.
My Erica, we have several callers on the line.
Okay.
Let's hear from Will. Will from Missouri, who is a resident student of or scholar on August Comp. Will, how are you?
I'm doing very well, Michael, and thanks for taking my call. Erica, wonderful broadcast, and I like the article that you had with News with Views. I've got two questions. One of them, were you ever able in your research to come up with a reliable biography?
Of Comp?
Yes. Like a Harriet Martineau or a Richard Congreve?
There are. I think I haven't thought about that too much lately, but, you know, he had this Clotilde DeVoe or something.
Yes.
And he was madly in love with her. She was his friend, but she didn't allow him to get any closer than that, and she wouldn't have married him, and she wouldn't have gone to bed with him. And maybe that's why he wants to change things for other people. If he can't have it, they can't have it.
Well, at least he control everything around him.
Yes. But offhand, I can't think of any titles for you.
Okay. The other question is, in regards to his veneration of women as a result of the relationship with Clotilde, how do you see that coming down today in the various work that Harriet Martineau did here in the United States and in relationship to women's trends now?
Well, I think the entire women's movement was predicted. I mean, you can read Comte and you can predict political events. And he said he couldn't get his system to work without the cooperation of women. And if you're going to flatter women and call them goddesses, and that women should be worshipped, which is what he said, you can understand why a lot of these silly women follow into the women's lib movement.
And the social sciences.
Sure.
Well, I thank you for your comments, and I'll continue to listen. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you. And we have another call, Roger from Allentown, Pennsylvania. Roger, are you with us?
Yeah, thank you very much, folks. I was just glued to the show, and I wanted to come back to this thing about legal positivism and the word altruism in that context, and what you said about worshiping women. It kind of reminds me, I think C.S. Lewis said that, you know, they worship man in the abstract, yet hate him in the concrete, that is, how he actually is. And I think that's a very appertaining point. This is a big joke because in Rose Martin's, it's probably now 30-plus-year-old book, The Great Deceit, The Social Pseudosciences, she shows how Comte invented, really, sociology out of whole cloth. And having read through two or three introductory sociology texts, one has to be, if one has half a brain, you have to be struck by the succession of logical non sequiturs, one after the other. And I really like to call sociology applied Marxism, because that's, I think, a better summary term than anything.
I think sociology kind of preceded Marx, didn't it?
I don't know, but I think
sociology actually is much broader in its concepts, because it just touches everything.
Yeah, and it's so irrational, like I said, with the chain of logical non sequiturs. It's really a big scandal that you can actually get PhDs in that slop. And if lastly, and I'll hang up then, I wanted to ask, if you wanted to explicate further on this, is that the doctrine of legal positivism goes an additional step, that whereas law was regarded prior to this doctrine, and it's used by various jurists, explicitly, certainly implicitly, and that is, whereas law was used to ban or punish bad behavior, the doctrine of legal positivism has it to force good behavior. And I'll leave you at that to explicate, if you please, and God bless.
Thank you.
Thank you, Roger. Well, Erica, do you have some reaction to Roger's comments?
Well, as far as the legislation is concerned, maybe not directly to what he said, but the sociologist and Count wrote that legislation is no longer going to be made by the legislators. It's going to be made in what you call the sociological laboratory. And he said the legislative bodies will need to be continued, but merely to put the sanction of society on what has been drawn up in the sociological laboratory.
Well, just several weeks ago, we had a show on the Commission for Uniform State Laws, and how each state's laws really aren't made by the legislators we elect, but are made by this commission that sits behind the scene, a group of lawyers.
I suspect a lot of that is also done at the universities like Harvard. And, you know, before the congressmen even go to Congress, many times they go to Harvard to learn how to legislate.
My. Well, I know here in California, if you're elected to a local position, you're sent to training sessions where you get your insights on how to implement smart growth policies and other sustainable development programs. So, you
learn policy instead of law.
Exactly. And that policy is the sociological outbirth that has evolved and grown out of this positivist philosophy, which is a very scary notion for all human beings, it strikes me.
Well, and when you realize how many, you know, you go to the library and get an encyclopedia of associations and realize how many associations there are, and there are now over, well, I would say there are over 2,000 who are now members of the United Nations non-governmental organizations. And when you join an organization that has policies, they're speaking for you in those policies, and they're all working with the United Nations. I mean, almost any organization you can join is connected to the United Nations, so you can see how, through leaders of these organizations, it goes into all the communities around the country, and people, it's amazing, you can go to one town or another, and everybody thinks they're original.
Well, that's certainly what we see with these visioning processes and the various guests we've had from all over the country talking about the notion of their local program, which they've been able to discover is just like the program that sits in a county across the state and sits across the state line at counties in other states, and it all ends up coming down either through federal agencies or organizations, NGO organizations that you're talking about, whether it's the Chamber of Commerce.
Years ago, you know, in the local meetings years ago, they used to put butcher paper on the wall, and then they'd ask people for ideas. And you're not supposed to criticize anybody else's ideas, and they write them all down on the butcher paper. And many of them are very, very simple. And the people don't realize that anybody could think of the things that they're putting on this butcher paper. And the first meeting I went to, that somebody put something on, and then everybody would applaud and make them feel good. And now, instead of the butcher paper, 3M makes regular boards.
Yeah, they're like big post-it notes.
Big, that's right. And they have pages that turn over, and you have to know that it's being done everywhere. It would certainly not be profitable to make these big boards for people who conduct their meetings.
Well, we have meetings like that all over this county. They've gotten a lot more clever because now they won't even open it for general comments or conversation. It's usually the facilitator now who takes nearly full charge before they put you at little individual tables, so that if they do have someone who understands the process and would make that information known to others, they've got them bottled up in a small table, and then they can surround that table with the wandering facilitators to keep it all under control. But this process, I would just say this, though, that back when they would use the sheets here in Santa Cruz County, if you mentioned anything having to do with private property, they'd smile at you, go, well, that's a nice thought, and move right along without putting it on the board. So it wasn't that they took all ideas and put it on their little charts.
Well, and that process and that kind of training is everywhere, whether you go to a parent meeting to decide.
Well, that's using people to make changes so that they'll go along with the changes. And, you know, there are a lot of people who've never been in an important position in their life, and it's a ego boost for them.
Well, and you get that ego boost here and in many places by going to these so-called leadership courses where they teach you how to be a perfect follower and call you a leader, and you do the dirty work of the change agents that way.
Well, then you don't even really get to be a leader, because if it goes wrong, you can blame all the other people.
Well, you know, everything is leadership. It's a pyramid scheme, the guy at the top and the one underneath and the one underneath and the one underneath, and they all have a leadership position training their subordinates, but they're training them in a system that they have to be trained in before they use it.
And it's devoid of individual thought, because the criteria for this is that you accept group mentality, group thought.
Well, if you don't do what you're told, you're not doing it right.
Well, and you're off the system. We have another call, Erica, okay. Jeannie from Aptos here in Santa Cruz County. Jeannie?
Yeah, good evening. I have a question.
Speak up a little, Jeannie. It's hard to hear.
Okay. How do the Jesuit priests fit into this equation?
I didn't hear the question.
And the question was, how do the Jesuits fit into this equation? Or do they?
I think that I haven't really gone into the Jesuit philosophy or any of the Jesuit teachings, and for me, I don't know that it's that important, because there's nothing I can do about it. I'm interested in the things that I can do something about. For instance, the Chamber of Commerce, I can see them, I can touch them, I can talk to them, I can warn people about the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and what they're foisting on the local groups, and it's something that I can really work with. In sociology, I can warn people, don't let your children take sociology, try to get away from the funding of sociology, but, you know, what can I do? If I'm going to study the Jesuits, whether they're in it or not, there's nothing I can do about it.
Well, that's fairly well said.
Can I comment on that? Because as I understand, they have infiltrated the Catholic Church and also other churches and other front churches that they have created. And their philosophy is very much what you're talking about. They do not believe in private property. And, of course, they said that Jesus Christ was a communist. So it does fit in very precisely
with the churches in the
United States.
I agree with you on that, because I had a personal experience.
Go ahead. We have another 40 seconds or so.
Oh,
for the next break.
A personal experience with a boy I knew. I was on a date with him, and he said, Janet, what would you think if I told you I was a communist? and he said that being a communist, he had been told to become a minister. And I imagine if he was told that, there were quite a few others who had been.
All right. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Jeannie.
Well, as we come back from another station break, we've got a few minutes left in the show, and what we'll want to talk about is maybe a few more examples, Erica, of how positivism affects all aspects of the human endeavor and society. We'll be right back at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. We're back here at the Freedom 21 Santa Cruz radio show with our last segment this hour with our special guest, Erica Kyle, author and researcher and student of the positivist philosophy of Auguste Comte, an early 19th century French philosopher who really has outlined in incredible detail a scheme for change, the kind of change that we're seeing coming at us from all aspects here today. One of the areas that really fascinated me was Comte's call for the focus on ruling families, the concentration of capital, and the combination really of government and business interests. What can you tell us about that?
I was going to go in a different direction, and I had my mind on it.
Well, go ahead. Do what
I was,
you
I was going to bring up the White House Conference on Children in 1970.
Oh, and Richard Nixon is president.
Yeah, and it gets into environmentalism. I'll read you some of the headlines, and you can stop me if you want to hear more. If a child is injured, the environment must be changed. Automobiles must be limited. Ecologists must plan communities. Get more land under public ownership. This is all from the President Conference on Children.
Wow.
And then on education for environmentalism, in the 70s, they had a push for futurism. I don't know if you've heard of that, but it was very, very prominent. And there was a book out on futurism, and it said, students must be shocked and shaken. In short, if a teacher really wants to change student behavior through an ecology unit, something new and fresh will have to be offered. Students need to be shocked and shaken repeatedly. Their feet must be held to the fire until they cry out in protest. We use a number of science fiction stories to revitalize tired ecology units, and most of them hit the students hard. Now, isn't that a dirty trick?
Now, is this happening in schools today?
Probably.
Okay. There's certainly a lot that goes on in the school system. And
but this book was 1973, and I was so shaken after that I had to go and talk to my friend and practically be deprogrammed because that meeting was horrible. It was a meeting of sociologists from around the country, around the Milwaukee area.
Well, we certainly know that here in California, every class now by state directive is to have an environmentalist element in it. You can be in a math class, it's got to have an environmentalist element.
And they scare the wits out of the kids.
We'll be right back here at Freedom 21 Santa Cruz in a moment. We're back here for the last few minutes of this interview with Erica Kyle on positivism and the philosophy that is intended to shape our world. In the last segment, Erica's been talking about environmentalism, really dating from the 1970s, and the White House Conference on Children dated from 1970, and how it has been the policy, I guess you could say, from the federal government since that time, that children be indoctrinated with a different set of ideas about how the environment and human beings are to relate and the order of things, really putting the environment ahead of human society and creating the control. Going back to the beginning of this show, the idea that there must be an external pressure placed upon society in order to gain the control over them, and the environment has been the agent of choice from Auguste Comte on right here to today, and as we see that really begin to flower. Continue with
that. Well, I had a question because I know we're going to lose you real soon, and I want to get this out before you go. You know, many of us might know people who are involved in the Chamber of Commerce, and, you know, they may be well-meaning people, and you talked about, you know, being able to have an effect on things that we can do. How do you approach someone who might be in the Chamber of Commerce to kind of let them know what they might be being a part of?
I have not been too successful in approaching people in the Chamber of Commerce. You know, there are a lot of benefits for joining. I think they have insurance plans. I think they have many benefits that are financially profitable for the people, and they think they need it for the business. And I think that I like to talk mostly to the people who are receptive and want to learn.
Sure.
And it's very difficult. I'm not saying you shouldn't contact the people in the Chamber of Commerce and let them know what's going on, but don't be disappointed if they won't hear you.
Well, so many people who are members of the Chamber of Commerce do it because it's a local networking group, and it allows them to meet other business people and share dynamics that benefit them.
And how can you look at all these nice people who are members of this nice organization and think that the national is not a good thing?
Well, it's the same thing with the American Farm Bureau, and it falls down to some of the local farm bureaus have the local farmers' interests in first front, and other farm bureaus, and certainly the national.
Well, I think maybe I'm going to interrupt you, because I think maybe talking to people of the Chamber of Commerce, don't tell them get out of the Chamber of Commerce. Tell them to change your local Chamber of Commerce and be aware of what they're doing and to object to what they're doing if it's not good.
Well, there's no question that the chambers in this county have, they've even had certain persons go through these chambers, and now they're off in other chambers. There's one fellow who went from here to Tracy and came from here from New Mexico, and he's just been an agent of Agenda 21 transformation.
Well, what I'm saying is very interesting. Many former politicians are now going in to be heads of chambers of commerce.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised.
Well, in the next hour, our subject will be habitat conservation plans, and the man who headed up the habitat conservation plan countywide in this county then became the Chamber of Commerce president.
Uh-oh.
So it all does float and fit together. Once you
I might mention I have a couple articles on the Chamber on the News with Views.
And people can get that by going to newswithviews.com and finding you as an author, and then clicking into the archive.
Check those chamber articles.
Okay, and that's a very worthwhile thing to do. And if you want to read Erica's summary of Comte quotes, go to freedom21santacruz.net. That's f21sc.net/radio. And right there, you can click right into this article that has formed the basis of our discussion tonight. I want to thank you very much for being with us, and all the great research work that you're doing. And I'm so happy that you're spreading this word far and wide.
Well, I want to thank you for making what Comp Plan better known. It's very important.
It is very important indeed. Well, have a good week recovering from Wilma down there in Florida.
Thank you.